Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that delightful instant when you jump up and down and shout, "Yes, I'm in." And you're not only in, but in at the right program for you. Now, once you are in, many of you will have the following refrain running through your head. Money, money, who's got the money? Specifically, the money to pay to attend the fantastic program you just got accepted to. That is a major hurdle for most graduate school applicants, and it's an even bigger hurdle for many international applicants. Today, I'm interviewing an expert in funding for international MBA students. In the meantime, I want to issue a quick reminder. If you have an admissions-related question that you would like me to address, just go to the show notes at info.accepted.com/89 and post your question as a comment. You can also send me questions via email at questions@accepted.com. If your question is chosen, I'll ask and answer it on the show. We're developing a supportive, collaborative, and thoughtful community on Accepted, so feel free to comment, share a concern, or ask a question. At this point, I'm thrilled to introduce Cameron Stevens, co-founder and CEO of Prodigy Finance and an INSEAD MBA. Cameron currently resides, co-resides in London and South Africa. He earned his bachelor's in finance from the University of Cape Town in 1999. And before joining INSEAD's class of 2006, he co-founded a corporate advisory firm in Southeast Asia, which successfully listed a technology company on the Malaysian Stock Exchange. He describes himself as a, quote, serial entrepreneur with a special focus on social entrepreneurship and early stage technology investing. Since August 2007, since August 2007, he has served as the CEO of Prodigy Finance. Cameron, thanks for joining me on Admissions Straight Talk. It's a pleasure to speak with you today.
Thanks so much, Lynn. It's wonderful to be here today from sunny Cape Town.
Great. What is the story behind Prodigy Finance?
I think, Linda, it was very much a personal journey when I was, as you just mentioned, I was living in Malaysia, and I got accepted into INSEAD, which was really the school that I felt was the best fit for me. So it was a very exciting moment, and I traveled to France to join the program, and when I was there, I had a number of discussions with fellow classmates, and INSEAD is a particularly diverse and international student body. And I had a lot of conversations with fellow classmates about funding, and it was raised just as a spontaneous topic, and people saying they couldn't understand why it was so difficult to get funding to attend. And I joined just before the credit crunch, which really made the situation worse. But even at that time, the situation for international students was difficult. And some countries and some nationalities were very lucky and had a lot of options, but many people from around the world were raising this as a big issue. And the refrain constantly was, they don't understand that it was so difficult to get into the program, and they feel that they are a creditworthy borrower, but really struggling to get that across and communicate that to banks. And many people who we found out later were not able to join the program because of this problem, but the people who had arrived and managed to get funding had gone through a very difficult process to do that. And being entrepreneurial and thinking about it in a bit more depth during the course, I thought that this was something that would be very interesting to solve. And as an entrepreneur, you first of all think, is it really a problem, or is it the notorious N equals one sample size in which you have a conversation over a couple of beers and you think this is, let's make a business out of this. And we did some surveys across some of the top universities in Europe and found out that it was actually a really prevalent problem across multiple schools and multiple degrees. And that crystallized the thought in thinking, this is something, it appears that it's a very sizable problem. It's a very global problem, and it's one that there's no reason that you can't solve. And so we set about doing that, and did a few courses during the year at INSEAD on just crystallizing the idea and the business model. And I'd also had a an interest in really crowdfunding since my undergraduate days. I wrote my undergraduate thesis on effectively crowdfunding, or what it was at the time in 1999. I know crowdfunding suddenly become very popular now.
That's
in 1999,
prophetic at that
the first
point.
One, yeah, it was really in its infancy, and the first one that ever happened in the world was a brewery in New York called Spring Street Brewery, which is a direct public offering to the public over the internet for $5 million in 1998.
Really?
And and then the whole industry died for many years until it's become very popular now in the last couple of years. But this was something that stayed with me, and the thinking of that, and thinking about activating a community of investors to fund something. And seeing this problem for people and thinking about how to solve it. And those two ideas came together, and that's really how Prodigy was started.
Wow, that is some story. Now, how does Prodigy Finance work in terms of the borrower? I mean, what would a student borrower go through, and how does it work?
Sure. So, I mean, basically what we did is we first of all looked at the student side to say, what are the issues here for the bank? Why is it difficult for banks to think about this? And really the answer is quite simple, that banks are very nationally orientated. Generally, you have a branch network. Even if you think about a big global bank like HSBC, which has a presence in multiple countries, it's still structured in a very national way. And so when HSBC, for example, is lending at London Business School, it's not HSBC Global lending there, it's a branch in Baker Street sitting there with a UK personal lending template trying to take applications from people from around the world. How do you think about risk in that context? How do you think about checking someone's financial affordability when they're about to experience a step change in earnings, etc.? So there are a lot of problems that we saw the banks having. So we thought, how do we solve these for the students, but in a fairly scalable way? For the funding side, and really what our value proposition is, and what Prodigy does in essence, is we source funding from a community of investors to make loans to international students. So the investors on the investor side are looking to earn a return, but they're also very interested in the impact that they're having in funding this group of high potential students from around the world. And quite simply, when we started, the investors came from the alumni community of the school, and it was alumni from that particular school that would fund students, and that's a very natural investor community to have. It's people who understand the risk at that school. They've been there in that same position, and so they can, compared to a bank, they can really think about what it means to fund a student at Oxford or INSEAD or LBS or wherever you studied. And so for those investors, we offer them the opportunity to earn a decent return, particularly in the environment now. If you're sitting with your funds in the bank, you're earning less than 1%, 0.5%, whereas you can earn 5.5% through our platform. But you're also having an impact in the world with your money. You know who you're funding. You can see on our site and on our platform who you're funding exactly, and you fund a class of students. So as an investor, you would choose to fund the Oxford class of 2016, and you would receive a bond from us which covers that class, and on our site you can see exactly who you're funding. On the student
side,
you
can literally see the students that took out loans from Prodigy Finance who are part of the Oxford class of 2014.
Correct.
Or whatever it is. Okay.
Correct. The repayment status is visible to that investor community. It's not public. We don't make that publicly available, but to the investor community or the alumni investor community, it's visible. And what you're creating there is a nice connection, because it's people who are interested in the future of these students, and that has positive implications beyond just the funding. You've been funded by a group of high net worth investors and entrepreneurs and alumni from your business school who believe in your future. And they're interested in seeing who they're funding and where their money is going. And of course, there's an additional benefit, and this was an innovation of ours, and we borrowed this slightly from microfinance, but in that social pressure that is created by that. The positive aspect is that you're being funded by a community of investors who are very involved in your, or interested in your future. And the social pressure that results from that is that if you can pay, but for example, if you took a loan from a bank and you move back to Singapore and you decide, I'm not going to pay because, you know what, it's Barclays in the UK, there's nothing they can do, and they'll never find me here anyway.
Right.
In our scenario, you're walking away from a community of your peers and alumni from your school, and so that decision is much harder to make. And so we have fantastic repayment performance. And on the student side, that offering is that we are able to provide loans which don't require guarantors or co-signers, which is something we've focused on initially.
Right.
And we can cover 150 countries around the world. We already have 95 nationalities in our portfolio to date. So we really cover off a good portion of the world. And a lot of people talk about being global. That's our DNA. This is what we were built to do. So that's the benefits that end up on the student side. And obviously, this is at rates that are competitive and we hope compelling. We're always trying to reduce the rates, but it's that balance between what you're giving to investors and what
Sure.
you're giving to students.
Now, just a couple of questions came to my mind. So the banks obviously are well, if you borrow from a bank, in some respects, you're anonymous. I mean, obviously, the bank has a record of you by name, and there is an impact on
Yeah.
credit and stuff like that. But like you say, if you move to a different country, what are they going to do? The bank has no recourse. In your
Yeah.
case, essentially, it's a person's reputation is your recourse.
The, Yes.
the borrower, the student, is responsible regardless of where they are because they are known to the community of investors who invested in their class.
Correct.
Right, that's essentially
Correct.
That's the reputational factor is essentially the collateral.
Exactly, and what you're doing, and there's two things in thinking about a loan when there's a willingness to repay a loan if you think you can get away with it, if you think there's no consequences, if you think you can move to China and the bank will never find you, which is probably the case.
Right.
That will reduce your willingness to repay, even if you have the ability to repay. And then the second thing is the ability to repay. Are you earning enough that you can actually repay the loan and that you don't end up in a situation with too much debt that will put you into difficulties? And we've handled those two points slightly differently, so certainly differently to a bank. So on the first one, it's as you say, it's the reputation, it's the social capital, it's the fact that a banker thinks about risk for the last few hundred years in being comfortable that you live down the street and they know that you live there and you've lived there for 5 years and they can find you there and that makes the bank comfortable.
And that you have equity in your home.
Yeah.
equity in your home. See the part of it.
Yeah. And then the world is much more online, much more digital, much more mobile. People can move around, particularly international students. And that world has changed. But your social network moves with you. You're still on LinkedIn. You're still on Facebook. You're still interacting with your community, whether you're in Dubai or New York or Singapore. So that's moved on. And whereas the bank still wants to know your credit record, which is very much influenced by that you've been here for a good period of time and it's very local. And so that's on the willingness side. And then on the ability side, a bank will look at your current assets or your current income or your guarantor. So they'll say, we'll do a credit check on your guarantor, or you can provide some collateral or property or something else. And that's how they think about ability. But you're talking about someone who might be coming from Chile, who's earning $15,000 with no major assets now, who's going to go to Stanford, who's going to experience a significant increase in earnings by a factor from what they are on now, and you're trying to assess that future potential. And so we built a predictive scorecard to assess future earnings potential to allow us to make a better loan decision for the student, and it's better in two ways. One, because we can give them enough to study in most cases, the majority of cases, but it's also in not ending up at a point in which they're over indebted and they cannot service the debt, because that's also something that we don't want to do to the student. We don't think it's healthy for the student or for us or the investors.
Right. So what about the student that let's say is going back to China or intends to go back to China? Did you just say, I'm sorry, we can't make you a loan? Or do you adjust the payment terms? Or, how is that handled?
So
going back to Chile?
What our model does, what our model does is we've got thousands of data points from the universities, and we make correlations between entry profiles. We don't obviously get any individual names from in the data, but we make correlations between entry profiles, which includes things like GMAT and age and salary before studying and country of residence, etc. And we look at exit salaries for those students, and we build a statistical model to assess someone's future earning potential. And that's based on the fact that many of people do return. About 70% of our students return to their home country immediately after graduation, and the number's a bit higher if you take that sort of 2 years out. So we expect people to return, and I think what's a fascinating dynamic, and this is really the last maybe 10 years for international students, is that before, if you came from, I don't know, Ghana, and you were coming to Wharton, let's say, and you're taking on a significant debt to study there, and really what you had to work in the U.S., maybe London, to be able to pay that off, because if you didn't, you're gonna have an issue. This was sort of maybe 15 years ago.
Right.
But in the last 15 years, what you've seen is this growth in emerging markets and a lack of skills that goes with it. So even in my home country, South Africa, you have a 40% unemployment rate, but you have 1 million skilled vacancies that cannot be filled because there's such a shortage of skills. Mm-hmm. So someone who's gone, who's the top of their country, who's gone to one of the top universities in the world, who comes back, is looking at a salary that's fairly comparable to the US or the UK. Because they're going to be snapped up by Google, Sub-Saharan Africa, or Unilever. Mm-hmm. Or McKinsey, and they're going to be on a much lower cost of living, but on a fairly comparable salary, not exactly comparable, but fairly comparable. And that's a dynamic, I think, in the last 15 years has been very interesting, certainly interesting for us in terms of who we're funding and why. But it means that the potential of those people is really being realized because they're in such demand. And in fact, there's less supply in these markets. And so salaries are very competitive, which makes it a very attractive proposition, well, both for the students and for us and the investors.
That's fascinating. So in addition to checking what a bank would check, i.e. credit score, credit payback history, record payment history, you will take this predictive model and also use it to determine whether somebody is credit worthy. Really, really fascinating.
Correct. And the size of the loan that we prepared to lend to them.
Got it.
And the terms of that to make sure that it's affordable, but sufficient to cover it. And in cases where we can't, we'll be upfront about that because it's not a situation that we want to encourage someone to take on too much debt.
Sure.
That can't be repaid because it doesn't help anyone.
Absolutely. Now, on your website, the site talks about servicing, quote, international postgraduate students. Do you mean anyone studying for any graduate degree outside his or her home country? Or do you, or is it still just MBA? I know it started with just MBAs. Who is eligible for a loan from Prodigy Finance? I guess that's basically the question.
Sure, no problem. We focus on international. Which means, as you say, someone who's leaving their home country. In some countries, we can also fund domestic students. So, for example, in the UK, we can also fund UK domestic students because we license in the UK as well. But other than that, it's the focus on a student who's leaving their home country to study. That's the international part. On the postgraduate part, we started obviously with MBA. We've added a number of the other business-related degrees. So we've added masters in finance and masters in management. And a number of the other courses that business schools offer, and certainly the exec MBA, which we just see as an extension of the MBA, and we launched our first pilot outside of the business schools in September last year. So we launched with engineering master's degrees.
Wonderful.
In the UK initially, and certainly that will remain a focus for the next couple of years as well. So sort of the STEM subjects: science, technology, engineering, and maths. But our model is certainly applicable to anyone who is high potential and has fairly predictable earnings trajectory. So that can be applied across business. It could be applied across engineering, the STEM subjects, across law and medicine, and many others. We're going to maintain our focus at least for the next couple of years on the postgraduate space because that's mm-hmm. where we feel we can have it. It's firstly very sizable, and secondly, it's slightly shorter course durations and better predictability of earnings.
Yeah, I would think
but
so.
But there's no reason we couldn't expand to undergraduate at some point. It's not on our current roadmap.
Got it. And I would think that, like, LLM degrees and medical degrees, I mean,
yes,
would be...
Absolutely, absolutely. And we're in discussions with some of our partner universities at the moment to expand. How quickly we can do that is up for debate, because we've got quite a few schools that we need to add to our list and our plans this year. But it's certainly on our roadmap.
That sounds like you have a lot of ways to go and expand. Like you're pretty busy. You have a lot. Thank you for joining me as I'm talking to you.
Does feel that way sometimes. But.
Yeah, like a little bit of a treadmill kind of thing, right? Hamster.
I don't know if it's treadmill and hamster or sorts of hurricane and a pack of rabid gerbils. But
regardless, there's lots of opportunity and lots of ways to keep you busy, huh?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, how can students apply? Well, you mentioned how they qualify for a loan. How do they apply? And what if they are accepted to a program that's not listed on your site?
At the moment, our strategy is to partner with the university. So that's how we have been rolling out and have rolled out to date. So the partner universities that we have about 35 of the top 100 business schools at the moment, including we've been making inroads into the U.S. This year, which has been and the end of last year, which has been quite exciting for us. But you have to have been accepted at one of our partner universities to apply, and obviously we expanding that list as we go, and so we definitely encourage people to let us know if they're accepted into another university in which we don't have a partnership, or into a course at the university in which we don't yet have a partnership, to drop us a line and we can see what we can do, or we can see at least let people know the time frame in which we can be going to those universities. But at the moment, you have to have been accepted into a partner university and into a course that's eligible. But that does change quite rapidly. And certainly would encourage people to let us know if there's a particular course or university that they would like us to have a look at.
Okay, and how would a student apply?
They would come onto our site at projectfinance.com, and they would be able to see on the site the terms for a particular school and program, and they would then complete a fairly simple application. It should take about 25-30 minutes on our site. Mm-hmm. And then we look to give them a rate and a decision within a day or two. And after that, then there's a process which they need to follow. And we have to do KYC and get some documents from the student through our platform online. But it's an all online application, and it's fairly clearly set out once they've gone online to apply.
So that's where the technology fits into your, thinking.
Yes,
about...
I mean, that's exactly, and that's something which is, I mean, it's brilliant for entrepreneurs today, because if you're sitting in 96 and you were trying to address a really global base of people, you would need to build out a branch network globally, and to compete with a bank internationally would be impossible. And even in 97, 98, the cost to build a technology platform and for a startup was significantly higher than investment you would require compared to an entrepreneur starting today.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the whole, I mean, when I first started Accepted, it was an entirely offline business. This was in the early 90s. And
yeah.
I started fooling around a little bit with CompuServe. And I'm not a geek. My sons, who are in computer software engineers, they kind of, like, you know, the old joke is, well, you ask your mother, you know, you want to test something, usability, you ask your mother,
yeah.
And they're like, well, you're not quite like everybody else's mom, but you're not really, you know, a software person. You know, like, you don't quite kind of fit the model, Mom. But in any case, I started fooling around, and I realized that the internet, or this whole, it wasn't even quote unquote the internet then, it was these services removed geographic boundaries. And then in, I think it was 95, then you had a browser, wasn't it, I forget even what it was called, but there was a browser that you could access the internet. The sites were very primitive. And I thought, well, let me try this out. And I was not going to sink tons of money. The business was very small then. I was not going to sink tons of money into it. So I took a four-hour HTML class, and I put up my own site. I'm also not, by the way, graphically gifted in any way, shape, or form. I'm strictly limited to stick figures and drawing. And I just said, you know, and I tried it, and the business exploded. It absolutely exploded. Because suddenly geography didn't matter.
Yeah, it's been an amazing journey for people. I think it's full of potential this next decade for disruption.
Right, and just getting back to your, you know, talking about the 90s. At the time, there was a very large. It was like January 1, 1996. There was a very large article in the LA Times magazine, and the LA Times at the time was a major newspaper. You know, like really get the Sunday Morning Times, and it was really, really thick. And the article was, can you make money on the internet? And the article was by the man who became the editor of, I think, Fast, one of the, you know, dot-com boom magazines.
Yeah.
Kind of grew and disappeared, or the Standard, or it was some major magazine at the time. And he wrote this article about how major corporations were pouring millions upon millions of dollars into their websites, their new websites, and not making and losing their shirts. And I wrote a letter that got published, and I said, I'm making money on the internet. That was my my big thing with my if you look it up on, you know, archives.com, it's a really very embarrassing to see what I put up. But it worked.
Yeah. I'll look at the way back.
Exactly. Now, do you ever, if I understand your funding model correctly, you get funds from investors who want to invest in students graduating from a particular school, and students apply or accepted to that particular school can apply for a loan. You check out their creditworthiness, determine if they are creditworthy, how much they can afford to borrow, and then you make them a loan. Do you ever run out of funds? Because like, can there be a mismatch between supply and demand?
So it was a struggle for us when we started, and in the first couple of years, we had a lot more demand than we could handle on the student side, and certainly when you first start, and we were really the pioneers in the space.
Yeah.
People have questions not just about the risk of the students; they have a risk about the company.
Sure.
Is this a business model that's sustainable? And many questions that point towards sort of uncertainty and risk when you're making an investment that made it difficult to source the funding. And
sure.
So we had excess demand. We had a lot of demand, and it was a constant challenge to get the funding in place. And that's really sort of switched over in the last year, in which we've been able to demonstrate a track record through the economic crisis of fantastic repayment performance, and the ability to deliver on what we promised initially. And so now it's a very different proposition for investors, because they can see that the model works, that we've got cohorts that have been through virtually a full cycle from start to repayment, and then you're really isolating the decision to say, what do you think the risk is on this class of students, and you know that, and we're assessing and validating that, and so it makes the investment decision a lot easier for investors. And so it's been quite a successful year for us last year in being able to get the funding that we need to be able to scale faster, and that's in hand now. And so I'd say at this point we still have limited funding in the sense that we can't cover the whole universe, but for the schools that we're partnering with and those that we want to add this year, we have sufficient funding. So that's been quite a change in the last 12 months.
And most of it is still provided by individual investors, or is it now? Do you have venture capital funding or credit lines?
For us, the majority of the funding is still coming from the community. So that's alumni and schools themselves in some cases, And we also have a partnership that we started last year with Credit Suisse in Zurich.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's very much sort of turbocharging our distribution to investors. So
sure.
We've worked with the impact investing team there, and we have a partnership with them in which they are offering effectively our platform and our product to their high net worth and family office investors.
Got it.
Who can invest through Credit Suisse, but you know, onto our platform. And it's a similar type of investor, and many of them are alumni from the schools. But it offers us access to additional distribution to investors, which has been fantastic. So that's been very helpful, and very much in line with the philosophy on investors, which is that they're looking for a return, but they're also looking to make an impact and to make a difference in the people that they're funding.
Great. All right, let's turn to a slightly different topic right now, and that is kind of your perspective on your experience at INSEAD and the whole MBA. What role did INSEAD and your MBA education play in the founding of Prodigy and in its expansion?
For us, it was particularly instrumental, obviously, given the space and the idea in which we started. So I think it's probably certainly instrumental because of that. But in terms of the actual the thought behind the question that you're asking, I would say that for us, what was most helpful about being at INSEAD was a few things. So firstly, being able to find co-founders. I think what's great about business school is that you mixed up with a group of fairly similar type A, quite competitive, very international people, but from very different backgrounds.
Right.
And so you have complementary skill sets, because you have sort of similar points in your life, share a similar energy and motivation, but come from different backgrounds. So it's quite a nice, if you're looking for something that complements you, then as a place to find co-founders and to work on something, I think it's very interesting. Our initial seed funding, we bootstrapped Prodigy initially and mm-hmm. funded it ourselves. Yeah. But our first round of funding came from a group of angels that were alumni from INSEAD.
Uh-huh.
And so that obviously was made possible by going to INSEAD ourselves. And we also use the time to be able to develop the business case. It gives you quite a nice, even though it's an incredibly busy year, and they describe it as drinking from the fire hydrant,
right,
particularly
right.
INSEAD, the one-year program. But and it was a very busy year, both socially and from actually getting through the degree and learning something. But it gives you the time, as a sort of step back from life, to be able to think a little bit and to actually use formal courses to progress an idea. So we entered the business plan competition, and it wasn't, and we developed a case on it, which we were working with one of the strategy professors, which was interesting. You have the best, you know, some of the best finance professors in the world that you can tap to think about ways of refining the model, and so it's a wonderful environment to be able to progress an idea through. In quite a focused way. So I'd say that those are the main bits. I don't think that, but I mean, all of those elements for Prodigy were pretty instrumental in terms of co-founders funding and being able to use the time to refine the idea so we could launch straight out of business school.
So did you find the classes themselves? I mean, do you use some of the information or knowledge or skills that you acquired at INSEAD in running Prodigy Finance? Or was it something that you kind of had to get through in order to get to the opportunity to start the business, the co-founders, and the funding?
Yeah. I mean, I'd say the formal training, and this is probably a comment on the – and it depends a little bit on your background.
Sure.
My undergraduate was, you know, a business-related degree,
right.
And, you know, with a finance specialty. So – a lot of those core courses were
elementary,
were second knowledge to me. And mm-hmm. although I would say that the difference in learning with the quality of professor was phenomenal, but I think the formal training, particularly if you're trying to be an entrepreneur and start something, I had that grounding, and I started two companies already before I went to NCAD. So for me, it was again second nature to think about business plans and funding and what that means. And I'm not convinced that business school or anywhere will teach you to be an entrepreneur. For some people, there'll be more value, and you'll be able to, if you've never seen a business plan and never written one and never gone for funding, there's some fantastic courses that will really help you to refine that.
Right.
But I would say for me, it was less important. The formal training was less important in establishing Prodigy for me. I think that would probably be, yeah.
That's fine. It's interesting. I was visiting London Business School once, and the admissions office arranged for me to meet with a couple of students. They were both very impressive, but the guy had just incredible finance experience, and he was a finance major. So he'd worked on Wall Street. He'd worked in venture private equity. He was a very dynamic, charming, articulate young man. And after listening to him and talking to him, I said, you know, I got to ask you this question. And it was in my head, and there was an admissions person, you know, somebody from the school sitting right next to him. And I just got to ask you this. I said, you have this incredible background. I said, are you learning something here? And he paused. He kind of looked at the admissions officer, and he said, if you had asked me this last year, he was a second-year student, I would have said no. I would have said no, which means he was basically wasting his time. But this year, I'm taking a class in value investing, and it's changing my whole perspective on investing. It's worth the whole time. Obviously, the answer will depend from student to student, and sometimes it may just be, in his case, it took a year of fundamental courses that were strictly review for him to get to some classes that he found valuable.
It's a similar piece in the sense of those more numbers based sort of accounting and finance piece for me were not massively value added. The bits where you really do take value and one of the courses that stands out for me was negotiation analysis. A lot of the softer courses for me, because that was something that I hadn't been exposed to as much.
Right.
And I think actually in the period we are now in which we're growing a team, we have about sort of 26 people now, and we're growing that. I look back and wish that I'd taken a few more of the courses that I didn't think would be particularly useful at the time, but definitely would be on the organizational behavior and some of the other softer pieces about leadership and management that would have been quite helpful for me now. But definitely, sorry, I think my point was very much focused on the entrepreneur, which I think is something which is difficult for business schools or anyone to create. I don't think it's a business school thing. I think there's a lot of learning you can do. But that's a particularly difficult one to create an entrepreneur. I think there's a lot of talk about entrepreneurship in the business schools.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it absolutely makes sense for entrepreneurial people to be going to business schools and people who want to start things, so 100%. But the number of companies that do actually start up straight out of business school is extremely low.
Right.
But what you do see, and this is with INSEAD as well, I mean, in our class, I can probably count three, including ourselves, who started, maybe four. But what you do see in the case of INSEAD is that 5 years out, that number changes dramatically, and so what you find is people are just finding their feet a little bit more, and they're using their training in business school, and then they do start something or they do become entrepreneurial. But straight out of business school, I think it's a difficult ask, and so I don't think that anyone's going to be very successful in creating a massive pipeline of immediately graduated entrepreneurs. I just don't think it's particularly feasible for various reasons.
And the debt being one of them.
Business school debt. Correct. Although I do find, and it's something that we've thought about quite a bit in Prodigy and how we can think of intelligent models to take that away and to be able to convert it into equity or to be able to convert it into equity in startups that are starting.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But quite honestly, when we've looked at the numbers of people who do start up, and I feel sometimes, and this is a personal view, but feel that the debt is used as an excuse sometimes for people who want to be an entrepreneur but not quite yet, and it's a fairly convenient one to be able to use, because I've seen people start and not start with and without debt, and there's never a perfect moment, and so I do agree, and I think it's something that we've thought about with Prodigy, about how to support entrepreneurs in a better way, and debt's a quite blunt instrument to do that with. And we've thought of various combinations of that, but it's such a small component still that there's just been other priorities for us to think about. Because
right, and I assume that if a borrower came to you and said, "Listen, would you consider, you know, taking an equity position in my company and you know paying off the debt or in lieu of payment?" I assume you would consider it.
Yeah, and we've had one or two who have.
Mm-hmm.
We would certainly, and obviously we have also a network of investors that are, in our case, they're Prodigy investors and investing in students, but many of them also would be natural angel investors as well in different industries.
Right.
And so that's a community that's very interesting and very powerful, and we're very happy to use that to help people who are entrepreneurial. But what you find, I think, and this is it's always a concern in the funding side, and it's why people want to see some skin in the game first and some pain first, because it's very easy to draw up a two-pager that you want to get sent out. And we've had this conversation a couple of times on someone with a half-baked idea that has done very little on it that thinks it's all about the funding. And says, "Well, you know, would you mind just sending this out to all the investors?" And you say, "Well, I'm sorry, you actually need to put a little bit of effort and work in first before it's going to go out to a community of very busy but interested if you give them the right material investors." So, I think that's another learning, and I think it's always the case when you have. That's why money isn't particularly easy. People want to see you just going through a bit of a sweat yourself and getting an idea to a point that you can fund. But you know, philosophically, absolutely, we're building a community of investors. When there's someone who has an interesting entrepreneurial idea and has done some work on it, we you know, happy to see what we can do to assist. And we've built in some mechanisms to allow payment holidays
mm-hmm.
for people. In the first instance, but beyond that, how we assist them in potentially getting funding is something we've talked quite a lot about, and certainly on a case by case basis we would look at.
Now, do Prodigy investors, like, let's say you have, all right, so you've lent a student to fund their MBA. The student is now a second year MBA, or in the case of INSEAD, approaching the end of their 1 year, and they're looking for a job.
Yeah.
Does the Prodigy community assist with that? Is there a job board? Is there, you know, any kind of assistance on that end in terms of the social
element? Currently, no. It's something that we've specced out in quite a bit of detail, because it's something that we think, you know, is a natural fit for us, because mm-hmm. we have screened high potential people from around the world at multiple universities, and it's interesting, obviously, to employers, and it's interesting to our students who've taken loans, who are thinking about jobs. So it's in our best interest, the investors' best interest, for them to get them. But we've prioritized being able to scale up our offering to more universities. Currently, it's always, I think, a difficulty in a startup in where you're putting resources and how you allocate it. It's something that I'm sure that we will offer in the, I won't say immediate, but fairly near future, and it's certainly on our roadmap. But it's something that comes second after being able to scale out to more students and more universities. But I think it's a natural fit for us, and I think it's something that would be value added. And would work for the students and for our investor community as well. So it's on the roadmap, but we don't offer it now, currently, no.
Okay. Any tips for applicants based on your MBA experience at INSEAD, as well as your experience now as a business person? So you think about what would you like somebody considering MBA to think about or know as they're approaching the process?
I think the first thing is really something about school fit, and I think the schools try to make a big thing about it. And when I was thinking about my MBA, I think it's something that it just comes across as a bit blasé, but it's really important to go to the right school, and the schools are different. Mm-hmm. And I think it can be a very different experience for different types of people at different schools. And sometimes there's a tendency just to think about ranking and just to think about these sort of very quantitative things, when it's important to be a good match and to fit with the school you're going to. So I would think about that. I don't think the schools are generic. I think INSEAD is very different to a Harvard or even a Wharton, and you know, equally Oxford and LBS. It's different offerings. So think about what is important to you, and when you're going through the decision process. And it just sounds, I know it sort of gets lost in the jungle sometimes. So I think that is important. I think the schools also emphasize quite a lot the, what are you going to be doing in 5 years? What's your path? And it might lead to a bit of angst in you thinking that you don't know exactly, but you have to put it out nicely in an essay and in interviews, and that's not an issue. I think you can just relax on that a bit and see how things go. You're going to meet a whole lot of people from around the world that have very different stories for you, and you should be open to that. So I think coming in with a very defined path is the wrong way to go. So if you know I'm going to be working in London and I want to work for Goldman Sachs and that's my path, and it makes you close to experiences with your classmates and with opportunities that come up. So I would leave that fairly open and not try to narrow it down too early. And it links a little bit to the recruiting cycle and people. There's some companies which are fantastic at recruiting at business school, obviously the consultants, the McKinsey's and the Bains. And I had people at the start of my year who said, I'll never work for a consulting company. It's never something I've wanted to do, and there's no way that I'll apply. And by sort of the 6 months, they were setting themselves up for McKinsey interviews because you just feel this rush of people, and everyone's talking about it, and you have to do it, and it's a herd that just goes, and it's very difficult not to be swayed by that. And so I would, again, just use the time, which you're not going to get very often in your life, to be able to really evaluate what you want to do and spend the time, and don't worry about where the herd's going and whether you need to be doing the same as the rest of the class. But I think it can lead to quite a bit of anxiety when you see everyone and it's just a rush for the job too early. And
at the exit.
So I'd keep it open.
Right. Well, I completely agree with you about fit. I also agree with you partially on your second piece of advice. I actually, and I certainly I'm pleased that you voiced your views, but I agree. I believe it's good to go into business school with direction, with some thought as to what you want to get out of the degree, but also be open to changing that. In other words, I think there's a big difference between going in and saying, oh, I'm going to figure it out when I'm there, as opposed to going in and saying, well, I think I want to go down this path, but I'm also going to be open to opportunities as they come up and the people that
I've experienced. Yeah, that's probably put a lot more eloquently and better. But yes, you shouldn't go in, you know, completely directionless and confused.
Okay.
But definitely don't go in with a singular focus. I would agree.
Okay, great. I think we're out of time, Cameron. You've been really generous, and I want to thank you so much for joining me. How can people learn more about Prodigy Finance and your work?
Best would be to go to our website, prodigyfinance.com, and you can see various emails there if you want to get in touch. But most of it should be on the website, and if it isn't, just drop us a line. Great to hear from everyone.
Okay. We'll include links in the show notes at info.accept.com/89 to Prodigy Finance. And Cameron, thank you so much. Listener.
Thanks, Linda. It was lovely to talk to you.
Great. Listener, thank you, too, for joining Cameron Stevens and me for our 89th episode. If you feel the show was helpful to you, I have a favor to ask. Please share the good word by leaving a review on iTunes. Your doing so helps us to spread the news about Admission Straight Talk, especially if you leave a 5-star feedback. You'll find a link in the show notes to our iTunes page where you can leave that review. And the show notes, again, are info.accepted.com/89, just the number 89. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.